Tears in my eyes, girl, while I'm waiting. Yes, good night, ladies and gentlemen. This is our cruise smile. Gonna entertain you for the rest of the night. My name is Vasquani. And this is our cruise smile. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for coming this evening. We're going to go ahead and start pretty soon, so if you want to grab a chair, please make your way there. Making their way to their seats at this time, we are going to start the presentation. And I want to say thank you again to Arc Roots, the band, and they will be playing later on this evening as well. I'll give you a quick overview of the program. We're going to go through some low-impact development projects that the county is undertaking right now. And then we're going to have about a 10-minute little intermission where people can get some more food, some pizza, a drink. We have Cayucas Cellars and Cayucas Brewing Company. And then we're going to sit down for Brad Lancaster's presentation. And at the very end, you all have a survey that should have been in your handout that was given to you. And so at the very end, you'll fill out that survey, and if you'd like raffle tickets, we have different raffle prizes at the table over there. You'll fill out your survey, receive 3 tickets. You can put them all in one box or put them in individual boxes. The prizes range from a rain harvesting kit, which is a big one, to some smaller gifts such as a New Frontiers gift pack. Anyway, so you'll be able to become familiar with those at the end and at intermission. Please fill in. That way, if we need to grab more chairs, we can. And can everyone hear okay? Everyone enjoyed the pizza. It was courtesy of Full of Life flatbread pizza. We also had some additional donations from New Frontiers for toppings and La Terraza Organic Farm in Los Osos Valley. Tonight's presentation is going to begin with Jill Falcone. She's the Stormwater Pollution Prevention Coordinator for the County of San Luis Obispo Stormwater Management Program. She's responsible for implementing a number of water quality programs in the county aimed at preventing pollution at its source. She leads the county's low-impact development team, and we're proud to have her with us tonight to talk about some of the projects going on.
Thank you very much, Rachel, and thank you very much for putting on this event for us. Generations before us cherished and celebrated the rain. In fact, they did rain dances and everything they could to bring rain to them to nourish the soil and to water their crops so they could survive. Now we think of rain as storm water, and we put it in pipes, we put it underground, we try to get it off our property as quick as we can, and we consider it like a waste. And urban stormwater now has become a liability, a pollutant stream that we try to send to our creeks and to the ocean full of pollutants. But now there's a new way of thinking that really isn't so new. It's really trying to return back to nature, to unlearn the stormwater management that's been in place for maybe the last 60 years. It's probably followed the evolution of the car. Funny thing. So as we started using cars and we paved over the earth to create habitat for the car and to make it convenient for us to use our friend the car, we have degraded our watersheds. And the technologies that we use then to make it easy for us to use the car then required us to put our rain then in these pipes and put it underground. Now, the new way of thinking now of stormwater management then is to return back to the natural ways of stormwater management, and that is to daylight the rain, and that is to return back to a more natural state by reducing the amount of paved surfaces in the watersheds and to preserve the natural states of the watershed by preserving existing vegetation and the contours of the land. And by using various strategies like green roofs and other things that you're going to learn about today from Brad that you can do on your lots and that you can do on wider scale in the watershed. The reason why these are so important is as the amount of pavement, or what we call impervious surfaces in the watershed, exceeds about 10%, the degree of downstream degradation in the streams becomes very, very severe, and water quality suffers very, very dramatically. The result of this is not only water quality degradation, but severe damages to groundwater and erosion, damage to wildlife, to the fish, sedimentation downstream to damage to fish spawning grounds, and very, very dramatic degradation to the environment. And you'll hear a lot more about that from Brad as well. To combat this, the county and municipalities across the country have developed stormwater management programs. And here in SLO County, all of our cities and the county have these. And these are federal and state mandated programs, in our case, a five-year permit program that requires what is known as low-impact development. And in our case, low-impact development will be mandatory by March 2010, and this is by ordinance. So these are dramatic changes to existing county code that require low-impact development. We have a low-impact development design standard manual that is in development now that is required by March 2009, And we will be taking this manual to public workshops in November. And I would like to ask your assistance in being involved in the public process to get your input on this manual. These are very dramatic changes to the existing codes and to enable low-impact development to be implemented rapidly in the county. We really need your support because these are very dramatic changes. Without these changes, low-impact development really cannot occur. We are very fortunate to obtain two very important Prop 40 grants from the State Water Board. These grants enabled us to do some demonstration projects. Keep in mind that low-impact development is new. Although it's common sense and natural, so to speak, the engineering schools have taught a different way of stormwater management for quite a long time now. So there's a lot of education needed to relearn these things. And so these two demonstration projects, this one is in Santa Margarita, and if you get a chance to check out our boards back here, you can see the new design of bioswales and one of an enhanced wetland. These were designed by RRM Design, and the two designers are here, Tim Walters and Leif McKay. They're here tonight, so you can talk to them about the design. And the upstream wetland is hydrologically connected to the bioswales, and so it's kind of a interesting connection here. You can see the upstream wetland prevents the downstream pollutants, slows down the stormwater from picking up the urban pollutants from the town itself and then carrying these into the creek, Urban Brunnick Creek downstream. The native plants then act as a sponge more in these bioswales. And it's very important that they're native plants because they can survive under the conditions. In this case, these are wet swales. And so these are plants that will survive in a low-lying area like Santa Margarita. So before construction, this might look appealing. However, this wouldn't carry the flow. And so it flood very severely in this particular area. So the swales were reshaped to give them a gentler slope to prevent erosion, and then planted with the native plants. And you can see some yellow flowers, and these are Goldfields, native California plants. Okay, and do they work for pollution? Yes. Here you can see our friend the car dribbling pollutants. These are two storm inlets down here on the left, and they are from Highway 58, Caltrans in storm inlets. And here on the right-hand side, you can see pollutants coming from those cars. And these are entering the swales, but they're not going to make it to the creek. So the swales, the plants, and the soil bacteria are going to handle those pollutants and break them down before they'll make it into the creek. So bioswales work. Okay, what we learn from these demonstration projects is that LID, we have a big learning curve to learn how to work with nature again. But it takes a team of people. And we need to have civil engineers work on a team with landscape architects and the environmental specialists and the construction guys. But really, really important is to work with the property owners and the citizens, because we need the citizens to help us take care of the bioswales. So it's really not helpful if somebody takes Roundup and uses that on the plants and things like that. And it also helps when the private citizens then work with their elected officials and say, you know, we really want to use rain barrels. We really want to disconnect our downspouts. We really want LID. Can you help us? Can you help change this code so that we can implement this right away? And then to work with the regulators, too, to make LID happen. And that, now I'm very happy to introduce Cheryl Lenhart of the Wallace Group. She will talk about the Florence Street demonstration LID project. She was the designer of that project.
All right. What Jill didn't say is she's absolutely fundamental to bringing low-impact development to San Luis Obispo County. So I think we really should give her a second round of applause because she's making it happen. So good job. The project that I worked on was in Templeton. It was a recipient of two grants. One was a Safe Routes to School grant, and the other one was a Prop 40 grant for water quality. The Safe Routes to School is because we have a lot of new development on this side of the freeway, and we have a lot of schools on this side of the freeway. And we want to get our kids walking and biking to school. We want to reduce the cars on the road. And the closest throughway was Florence Street right here. This is what Florence Street looks like. Would you like your kids to be walking or riding their bike on this road? The neighbors say it's incredibly a speedway. Basically, people are always late. They want to run to school as fast as possible, so it's an area of concern. I wouldn't want to put my kid on there. If you notice, we have a lot of water here. We have sediment coming across. Downstream, this is the top of the watershed. Downstream, it goes to Toad Creek. Sediment is really bad for creeks. The sediment, as well as pollutant loadings, if you have a lot of fertilizers on your yard or if you have oil and grease, is the groupie car that Jill showed bad things. We don't want that stuff ending up in the water. So this is what the codes, so the goals of the county are to get kids to school and on bike or by walking. We want to also improve water quality. Water quality you might think of as pollutants of concern, get the soil and the grease and the things out of the water, and that's where water quality has typically been. But the next generation of water quality says we're starving our groundwater systems and we're causing so much runoff that we're causing flooding. And so the next generation of water quality includes reducing the volume of water that a project would create. We're looking to maintain parking because this is a residential neighborhood and people currently park there and people go to the park, want to park down that street. We want to slow traffic down. We want to minimize maintenance because the county, just like many municipalities, are just financially stretched, and we didn't want to do anything that would cause them a lot of maintenance. And we certainly wanted to do something that would make it look like it belonged in Templeton. So, how well did you do? This is what you normally get if you follow all the codes in San Luis Obispo County. It's very functional. It has a bike lane, it has a pedestrian way, people can park. But it's really ugly, don't you think? Yeah. And it certainly doesn't look like most of Templeton. And what water does on a road like this is it goes into the curb and gutter, and then it'll go into an inlet, and then down to the creek. So it has nothing to slow down the bottom amount of water, nothing to treat the water. So looking at how this project, if we had done it conventionally, would have met the county's goals, yay, it has pedestrian path and bike lanes. That's good. This is what an inlet looks like if you pull the lid. I strongly advise to get out in the rain and look at what's coming down in the gutters. Pull the lid. If you pull the lid, be sure to put it back. That gets us in trouble. But this is what's sitting there waiting to be turn into a stew. And this is the stuff that you can see. There's all that other stuff that you really can't see. So that project, if we had done the conventional, would have been very good at maintaining parking. But when traffic is on a wide open street, it's pretty much like a freeway. You have nothing stopping you. You can just go. As you can see clearly, you have no level of uncomfort. There's no reason to slow down, nothing to look at. It certainly is cheaper for the county because they can come in and maybe clean this up twice a year, and they might street sweep maybe once a week. But it certainly didn't fit well with Templeton. So the county had the wherewithal to say, well, can we do something else? And can we get someone else to pay for us to do something else, which is also really a good thing from a taxpayer perspective. So this is the first approach. Instead of putting all the water in the pipe where it's out of sight, out of mind, and not getting all those good beneficials, how about if we kept it on the surface and we ran it through grass so it has a chance to have the grass itself filter through, and then if the water goes down, we're recharging the groundwater table, plus we're getting the additional pollutant treatment, and it's just a much prettier project. So then we look at, did this kind of project, would it meet the county's goals? And say, yes, we still have a pedestrian path, we still have a bikeway, but this project successfully treats the water quality regulations. It does it both in terms of the pollutants, because it's going through that grass and soil medium, but also in terms of reduced volume, because that first project had lots of pavement, and this project has much smaller pavement. The idea was that it would calm traffic down, because you have plants to look at, and the streets are going to be narrower. If it's done right with native plants, and it can reduce the maintenance, because now the county doesn't have to clean out any inlets and they don't have to do any street sweeping. And it certainly fits like it would belong in the community of Templeton. So this is what Florence Street looking down towards the creek before we did anything. And this is what it looks like afterwards. The feedback that we have from the neighbors is that these lanes here, which are 11 feet. Anyone remember when Cuesta Grade was under construction and how narrow it was and you felt really constrained going down the grade and you kind of do your cross and go? These are the same width, right? And that's by design because we want to slow people down. And we want to give a designated area for bicyclists to say, you know what, we belong here. This is our spot. Don't get mad at us. This is where we belong. And we wanted to give a spot here for pedestrians. But what this over here is different. It looks like traditional sidewalk, and it acts like traditional sidewalk. And I have a section of it back there if you want to take a look at it. It's called pervious concrete. And what pervious concrete does is it allows water to go through but still have a solid surface. So it looks kind of like Rice Krispies, but it does not taste the same, and it probably has more calories. So again, looking at it in more detail, from the surface, this is what you had. You had that rutting, pretty much ugly weeds, if you had anything growing on it at all, and a narrow street. And this guy never takes his trash can away, because there it is over there. So this is after the project. This intersection here is narrower than what the county would normally do. We've actually broke, just doing this from this, we probably broke, I think it was 9 major county regulations. So the county has stepped out. Yes, this is exciting, because if you don't try these things and you don't get the feedback, if you don't go to those public meetings and say this is what we want, you get what the county requires. So it looks pretty on the top. You have the nice plants. There's a list of the plants down there in the back that you can take a look at. The thing that I would like to say, though, is that even though it looks pretty good on top, it's really cool underneath, and I guess maybe you have to be an engineer to appreciate that, but I'm going to try. Underneath this soil matrix, where you have all those roots doing all their work and the ability of water to go down, there's a stone recharge bed down here. And what that tries to do is say, we added a little bit more road, and we're going to try to keep some of that water, and we're going to hold it and allow it to trickle back down into the groundwater before it would run off like it had typically done. So what you see underneath is we dug this great big hole. It's about 6 foot down the whole way. We filled a large portion of it up with uniformly graded rock. That gives lots of good void spaces. In areas where we didn't plant, we put this porous concrete. Porous concrete comes in a truck just like you know normal concrete, but it's very different. So you want to make sure you have someone who knows what they're doing, because it's much like Play-Doh, really, when you put it out, instead of using the whole vibratory thing. And then look at this. This is not a Photoshop picture. This guy can run his hose there until his wife gets mad at him for wasting all that water, or the water comes to the surface because the whole pool underneath is filled up. So this is going to take in a lot of water, a lot more water than what you would have just from, obviously pavement doesn't take any water. So those are kind of exciting things. What I learned from this from a community perspective is you come out with some pretty picture like this and you go, oh, this is going to work just great. How hard could this be? And then about $60,000 later, you start learning the appreciation, the subtleties of things that don't work well, like utilities. your utility is all underneath the streets. We flush our toilets. We don't think about where it goes. We get gas. We get electricity. Well, dealing a project in a neighborhood that's already developed is very expensive. So the amount of treatment that we got per dollar that we spent was probably not as good as if you did something on your lot. So keep it from getting, let's let the road treat the road and you guys keep your house water and we'd be a lot better served. So Rad will give you a lot of tips on how to do that. So we learned that the utilities were bad and they were difficult to work with. We learned that people don't always measure where the right-of-way is before they build their house or before they put their fence in or before they plant gorgeous trees. One of the benefits of pervious concrete is that not only does it allow the water in, but it allows air and water and nutrients to exchange. And so instead of having trees buckle the concrete, it is very happy. It just thinks that there's soil up on top. So it reduces the wear. Skateboarders hate it. They can't get enough speed, so if you don't like skateboarders, that's something, and I'm sorry for a skateboarder. You can use the bike lane, I'll share. We learned that, like I said, there were a lot of design exceptions, and the county, this is a good step for the county. Really, it takes a lot to get to this level, because there's a lot of concern about, well, what about flooding on the street? What about flooding downstream? County will get sued. What about, you know, sidewalk and curb and gutter protecting pedestrians? So this is a leap for the county. And what you're going to see later is some really cool projects, which we hope will be the next generation. But that's going to take you coming out to meetings when a project is being proposed and making it happen. So this is a retrofit project, very expensive. If you can get in on the ground floor, that's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. So again, this is the option A. This is what you get now. This is the path of least resistance. This is option B, and it can be even better. So I'd like to turn it over to Rachel, who made this possible.
And I do have to say there was a lot of people here, a lot of them lined up along the back or a little bit behind the scenes who really did make this possible. And also our funding came a lot from the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, and they have a display in the back. I also want to say that Cheryl Lendhart is a graduate of Humboldt State University, has a degree in environmental resource engineering, and she currently works at the Wallace Group where she heads up the drainage team. She's a licensed civil engineer and a LEED accredited professional who spent 9 years working on stormwater and erosion control issues and opportunities, and I think she's done a great project there. So. Some of you may have seen on our little flyers this word appropriate, two words, appropriate technology, and kind of wonder what's that all about. And back in the late 70s, we did see within the Department of State Architect an appropriate technology division that focused on the types of technologies like low impact development, gray water, composting toilets, things that are sort of this fuzzy gray area that are going to help solve a lot of our problems, but implementing them is a little difficult with the current codes. Locally, we have Slow Green Build, Surf Rider, and Sierra Club who have teamed up together, and we have an appropriate technology coalition. And so we do a series of fundraisers and able to bring these type of workshops to your community. So Jill mentioned this cross-functional teamwork, and that's very important, so I just wanted to reiterate that. And then also, Cheryl had mentioned how, you know, if you have an existing situation, it costs a lot more, whereas sustainability, if you integrate it from the beginning, it doesn't need to cost you anymore. And if you integrate it further down the line, that's when you start getting into a lot of changes and it becomes more expensive. So it's very important for that team to have sustainability goals when they set out on a project. There's also a lot of buzz about green building, and the U.S. Green Building Council is our national organization who's really been pushing for some type of criteria and a way to rate if a building is green or not. So when we say we're LEED accredited professionals, which I am also and Cheryl is, it's that we've gone through the training with the U.S. Green Building Council to use their systems and implement them on projects. We're actually really lucky here in California. We're the first state to adopt a statewide green building code. So right now it's voluntary measures and it parallels LEED very closely. And so we're looking at mandatory measures coming in 2010. So a little bit about LEED is the way it addresses issues of your project are with sustainable sites where they look at stormwater capture and treatment on site, also a smaller footprint for your building, open space, habitat restoration, and integrating alternative transportation, having bicycle changing facilities and showers, bicycle parking, and then also vanpool and that kind of stuff, and being near bus routes. I do have to say the next couple projects, the project architects are here. It is Ken Haggard and Polly Cooper, who have actually been applying a lot of these principles to their projects, and one in particular is the synagogue on Los Osos Valley Road. This is Congregation Beth David, and I'm showing a floor, a site plan here that illustrates that all of the parking lot water is drained into these areas over here where it's actually treated by tarweed. So they have on-site stormwater treatment, and this is actually a LEED certified project, so they were able to use that in attaining some credits for their certification. Water efficiency also comes up with the LEED system, so looking at pre-plumbing for reclaimed water use or gray water, drought-tolerant and native landscaping, so you reduce your potable water needs, also using rainwater catchment and efficient fixtures. This is the Botanical Garden. It's across from Cuesta College in El Toro Regional Park. And here, they also employ, aside from efficient fixtures, rainwater catchment with roof water. These two roofs here and here drained as cisterns, above-ground cisterns, that will be used for their summer irrigation needs. This project is still in the process of having the landscape built, so if you go there right now, you'll just see that the gutters are directed to where those cisterns will be. And then we have LEED that talks about neighborhood development and for homes, and that's when you start, again, looking at open space and reduced site disturbance and green access roads that are pervious that can be used for emergency vehicles. This is Tierra Nueva Co-Housing Community in Oceano, and all these projects were by the San Luis Sustainability Group. This was open occupancy in 2000, and what you see up here are green access roads. So these, they look just like turf, but they're able to withstand the emergency vehicles being driven on them. They also used all natural drainage patterns and have retention basins worked into them that have multiple functions. They become play areas in the dry season and then will fill up and retain the water on site in the off season. They also were able to preserve as much of the existing orchard of avocados. And these particular projects are mentioned in the handout that we gave. And again, the Morro Bay National Estuary Program did help fund this in large part because this area here is the watershed that drains into our estuary. And so that's a large area for pollutants to be picked up and carried downstream to affect the aquatic life and the water quality in the bay. So what's that? That's the little machine you put the quarters in for the boat wash down at the end of the Embarcadero. And this is a project that the City of Morro Bay and the Estuary and Greenbuild have all been looking at and saying, hey, you know, maybe there could be another demonstration project where it has high tourist visibility and solves a problem that currently exists. So that problem is you notice here, we've got our nice little island, and the water actually pools up on site, and then if it were flowing, it's going to go down this gutter, and then there's the next little island right here, and there's the little drain, and then it goes across and right into the bay. So people can wash their boats and engine blocks and different things. There's and RVs, and there's a high potential for a lot of pollutants to go directly into the bay with no filtering. So the existing, there's an island here, and then there's one a little bit further down about there, which is this one. And then we're looking at possibly creating another one here where they would be rain gardens that would actually help filter those pollutants before it went into the bay. So there it is again. And the back of this parking lot has some erosion issues. And so again, sedimentation that can be carried with the storms directly into the bay. So we're looking at, you know, what the phases or scope of that project could be and maybe some rehabilitation of the slope with some native vegetation. So there's a lot of activity and examples of low-impact development here in Slo County, and it's really exciting that we have Brad Lancaster here tonight to tell us even more about what we could be doing. And so we're going to take a quick 10-minute. Folks can get up, have a stretch, maybe get another drink or some pizza, and then we'll come back together and go into Brad's presentation. Thank you.
Eyes up.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Could I gather everyone's attention to start making their way back to their seats, and we'll go ahead and start Brad's presentation just so we don't keep you too late tonight.
same it was before. It hasn't
Yeah, I was going to see if everyone could have a seat right now. We don't want to turn the lights off because we don't want people to run into each other. Woo! But there we go. All right. All right, I'm going to go ahead and start introducing Brad Lancaster, our main presenter this evening. If you could please find your way to your seat. Thank you very much. Brad Lancaster is a permaculture teacher, designer, consultant, and co-founder of Desert Harvesters. He lives on an eighth of an acre in Tucson, Arizona, where the rainfall is less than 12 inches annually. That's like half as much as what we get. He practices what he preaches by harvesting over 100,000 gallons of rainwater a year. He taught at the programs at the Ecosa Institute, Columbia University, University of Arizona, Prescott College, Audubon Expeditions, and many others. He has extensive expertise with water harvesting and permaculture systems. Please welcome Brad Lancaster.
I want to thank you all for coming out. I'm going to start tonight's talk by doing a little exercise that I do for all kinds of students. It works for elementary students. It works for all ages. And my goal is, tonight I'm going to be giving you a lot of information, and I'm going to be conveying it in a lot of different ways, because I'm hoping that something sticks. Okay, everyone's got a different learning style. But I'm also trying to give you a larger toolbox by which you can communicate these principles and concepts to others. Okay? So let's start off with this little model, okay? So this would be a typical 4,400 square foot lot, okay? As you would typically see it in, say, southern Arizona, where we've got dirt lawns. And then you've got a little 1,000 square foot house, and let's see what happens when it rains. And this would be a more, kind of a more gentle winter rain. So you tell me what happens. Okay, what happened? All done to scale. So let's put those in. And let's have some more rain. Tell me what happens. Okay, what happened? Okay, we still lost some water to runoff, but not quite as much, because we did gain 3,400 gallons of water from these tanks, okay? We're going to come back to that. But what about, we still had, you saw a fair amount of water running off the site. And what we can do to capture that water is to create a sponge within the landscape, a rain garden effect of water harvesting earthworks that are well mulched and vegetated. Okay, so let's bring in the sponge. So here's the sponge. All right. Okay, we get it all set up. And let's now rain on it again. Now with both rainwater harvesting tanks and the water harvesting earthworks. Yeah, it is greener already. Yeah. We have any runoff? A little bit, but nowhere near as much as we had before, okay? So this time we harnessed the bulk of the rainfall, so we prevented flooding downstream. But let's see how much water we caught. Both of the tanks are full. So I've got this here measuring cup. 1,700 gallons. Yeah! Another 1,700 gallons. Yes! So we've got 3,400 gallons right there. Can you see where my pinky is? That's the water level. Now let's see what we get with the water harvesting earthworks. The sponge. Yeah! Can you see the riches? Oops, I lost some of it. Sloppy sponge squeezer. All right. And look at all that water. So we're harvesting, thank you. Thank the sponge. We're harvesting 5 to 10 times as much water. Plants are going to need that steady input of water like a vegetable garden. The tanks are the way to go. But if you want to water lower water use perennial plantings like a native landscape, the sponge is the way to go. Okay? And if you combine the two, you've got a great dynamic system. Okay? So that's it. Thanks for coming, everyone. Oh, yeah. How do you make the sponge? Okay. So, all right. So we'll go into a little more detail. Let me just mop up the spilled water. And I'll transition on over to here. Okay. So tonight's presentation, I'm going to be talking to you about the harvest of water. I'll be talking about the harvest of rainwater, gray water, and stormwater runoff. Okay? And I'm going to begin with these two images of my hometown of Tucson, Arizona, where we get 12 inches of rain and an average year of rainfall. And on the image on the far side would be your left. This is Tucson in the early 1900s. And you can see we once had a perennially flowing river, a river that flowed year-round. That is why Tucson is located where it is. And along with the river, we had abundant springs and wells throughout the Tucson Basin. So we had neighborhoods named Flowing Wells, Sabino Springs. And we also had these wonderfully intact pockets of mesquite bosque, or forests of mesquites, hackberries, willows, and cottonwoods. And when the rain fell from the sky, the erosive force of those falling raindrops would be diffused by the canopy of vegetation, and then the water would make its way more calmly to the mulched sponge layer below. So while we only get 12 inches of rain a year, back then, we got the bulk of that 12 inches infiltrating the soil and the watershed. But not today. Today we've replaced that sponge with pavement. So if you look at the image here on your right, over 30% of Tucson is now paved over. And we have lost the river, we have lost the springs, and we have lost the bosque, the forest. So to that. But first, take a look at the watershed more closely. And you can see that we are a hydrophobic society. We're doing everything we can to get rid of the water as quickly as possible. So on the left here is a typical commercial development that's 95 to 100% paved over, sheds the water very quickly, contributes to flooding in downstream areas, and then you need to use mechanical pumping to get the water back up to irrigate the landscapes, feed the toilets, and so on. And then on the right, we've got a house. And the house is on the high part of the lot, which is good, so it's not flooded. But they send the roof runoff right down in a rock-lined channel past the plants in the landscape into the street, and the concrete-clad drainage and these guns of Navarone shoot the water right out of the system. So we are literally dehydrating our watersheds, okay? We are desertifying our community because we're taking that free, abundant source of rainfall and getting rid of it instead of utilizing it as a beneficial resource. And so we have replaced once vibrant, thriving landscapes that needed no outside input, no human input to thrive, with landscapes totally dependent upon human inputs. So this is a typical Arizona landscape where we are putting in the plants, and then we send water to them, municipal water, through a drip irrigation emitter. And you can see there's white rings around each plant. Okay, that is the salt that has been deposited by our salty water. Okay, as we pump down our aquifer, the salt levels in our water increase. That's not the same. That's not the case in all aquifers, but it is for ours. And we're also importing Colorado River water from 300 miles away and pumping it up an elevation rise of 1,000 feet. This Colorado River water is very salty. For every acre foot of water we import 2,000 pounds of salt, which we then apply to our soils. And this is a real problem in the western United States, where we have alkaline soil, which is already high in salt. So if you continue to add salty water, you are going to build the salt levels. And over time, by irrigating, you're going to create a landscape that's more susceptible to drought. Okay, might sound odd, but as you increase the salt content of the soil, Arizona is the top view, is taken in the 1940s, and that is a view of the Santa Cruz River. But the only part of the Santa Cruz River you can see is this little light-colored section here in the bottom right-hand corner. The rest of your view of the river is blocked out by massive cottonwoods, willows, mesquites, and hackberry trees. If you look at the bottom of the picture, there's a large boulder, and there's a little saguaro. And when we jump to the image below, taken in the 1980s, it's taken from the same vantage point. And there at the bottom is the same boulder and the same saguaro. And you can see in just 40 years, we lost that dynamic sponge of native forest. Okay, that was not only the sponge, but that was the anchor that held the soil in place and built more soil, and was an abundant resource, a free resources of timber, wildlife habitat, food production, and so on. And the way we lost that is we overpumped our groundwater at a rate that exceeded natural recharge. So as the water table dropped, it dropped below the level of the roots, and we lost that wonderful resource. Okay, so here's where we have the rivers of today. They're in our streets. So it's no wonder we consider stormwater to be a problem or a liability. It's because we drain it off the surfaces where it would be a resource, such as our home landscapes, our home gardens, our ball fields, parks, commercial and public landscapes, and we send it into the street where it's a liability for traffic. But there's a real plus in this if we recognize the value of urban runoff kayaking. Okay, this can really kick in the tourism industry. So this photograph is of my neighbor Matt Weber kayaking down First Street after he passed two cars. So when people hear about harvesting rainwater, they typically laugh in the western U.S. Because they think that there is a scarcity of rainfall. But in reality, there's an abundance. And in my community of Tucson, where we just get 12 inches of rain a year, there is more rain falling on the surface area of Tucson than all citizens of Tucson cumulatively consume in an average year. Okay, so the average Tucsonan uses about 165 gallons of water per person per day, of municipal water. But if you look at how much rain falls on the surface area of Tucson, divide that by the Carolina, by not harvesting the rain, by just draining it off site as quickly as possible, not only does it worsen droughts, but it also is greatly worsening floods. And you notice you've got this very sediment-rich water, which is then clogging the local waterways and killing off the local fish populations. So I see we can take one of two paths. We can either take the path to scarcity, where we typically plant in such a way that we are draining the water and topsoil off these mounds that we plant on, and the sediment-laden water just flows into the streets and storm drains, causing problems. And we send our household gray water also out of the system. So over time, we're steadily depleting the natural resources of the site, so things steadily get worse over time. We become aware of this and perhaps concerned, maybe even scared. Scared to be in the city on the path to scarcity. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes. You're too kind. Okay. But we can easily turn things around, okay? Where with the same landscape, we instead plant within or beside water harvesting earthworks, basically rain gardens. We drain our raised access ways and gathering areas to these rain gardens. Okay, so our feet and vehicles stay high and dry. And these rain gardens, they don't just harvest rainfall and runoff, they also harvest the leaf drop and fruit drop, okay? So the nutrients are then able to recycle back into the plant, okay, and feed the soil. So we're not being depleted of nutrients, all right? And in addition, we send our household gray water to these same earthworks, these same rain gardens. So when we don't have rain, we have the gray water. When we do have rain, we leach the soils of their salts that might be introduced with some of that gray water. So over time, our resources are enhanced. Things get better over time. We become aware of this, maybe even happy. Maybe so happy, we want to take these here buns and do a little bun dance on the path to a bun dance. Yes. I can tell you, since there are no street trees planted in the public right-of-way, the trees are only planted on private land, basically we've expanded the hardscape and the street width an additional 10 feet on both sides, because you have a 10-foot right-of-way where the sidewalk and all is, but there's no vegetation, no sheltering. So this has led to the heat island effect, where the sun's rays and heat are absorbed during the day by the exposed hardscape. It absorbs it like a battery, and it radiates the heat out at night. This has contributed to a 10 degree Fahrenheit rise in temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona since the 1940s. That is not global warming. That is local warming caused entirely by local efforts. But it leads directly to global warming, because the higher the ambient temperature in summer, the more people are going to turn on their mechanical air conditioning. And how do they power that? Well, in our area, it's primarily with coal. And the thing is, we can easily shift to a different model, as is illustrated by the Village Homes development in Davis, California, seen on the right. There, the streets are no wider than 20 feet. The street is raised or crowned in the middle and drains the water to either side, where the water is then directed to some water harvesting basins in which the street trees are planted. So the street passively and freely irrigates the street trees, which then grow to shade over and cool the street. With up to 75% shading over the hardscape, they have found they've reduced summertime temperatures by 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, the local cool island effect. That also doubles as local flood control effect, and beautification effect, and cleaner air effect, and on and on. Okay, so very simple. Now let's look at a home landscape. So on the left, we have a landscape on intensive care, where we are planting on burial mounds and that rapidly drain water, topsoil, and fertility away. So we have to bring in intravenous-like drip irrigation emitters to replace the vital fluids we've drained from the dying patient. and care packages of fertilizer as well. And while this landscape receives 12 inches of rain in a typical year, the landscape is barely getting a fraction of that, and also sending roof runoff right on by a secondary water source. And municipal or well water only is a supplementary source needed in true times of need. And the way we achieve that is by setting up a landscape that captures, infiltrates, and utilizes the rain. So here, all the vegetation is planted within or beside sunken water harvesting earthworks or rain gardens. So all of the 12 inches of rain that falls from the sky infiltrates the soil. It's not lost. And then we send the roof runoff, which is about the same surface area as the landscape itself, that is also directed to and within the soils of the landscape, all of it infiltrated. So now, instead of just getting 12 inches of rain a year, we're getting 24 inches of rain a year. Okay? And then we've got the hardscape of sidewalks, patios, driveways. Instead of sloping that hardscape to the street, we instead slope it to the landscape. So then we get that contribution of runoff as well, thereby tripling the available rainfall. In this case, tripling it from 12 inches to 36 inches of rain a year, thus making it very easy to meet the more sustainable paradigm of water use where rainwater is the primary irrigator. Now, within the home, about 30% of the potable drinking water you consume is used to fill and flush the toilet. This is why dogs and my friend Mike drink from the toilet. But I think this is a very big problem. Why are we soiling our drinking water and then creating the need to spend billions of dollars trying to get the crap back out? I just want to plant a little thought seed, think it over, and let's leave the toilet talk at that. So let's get back to rainwater harvesting. How do you take that path to abundance? Well, in my books, I lay out 8 common sense principles in detail, but I'll give them briefly to you here tonight. And the first one is you start with long and thoughtful observation. You don't need a book or a talk or a class to figure all this out, although they help. But all you really need is just to get out and observe, particularly when it's raining. See where is the rain collecting and life being generated. Build on that. Where is the rain rapidly draining away and causing erosion? You want to check that, change that. And the next principle is you want to start at the top of your watershed and work down. All too often, we start at the bottom of the watershed where we see all the water. But if we collect it all there, how do we get it back? The site is hydrated, not just the bottom, and nothing's flooded. So this is a view of the Milagro co-housing development when it was under construction in Tucson, Arizona. This is a pattern that could be used for commercial office complexes, townhomes, schools, and much more, where the roofs of the green roofs of the buildings to either side of the common landscape in the middle, they drain to that landscape. And then the slope is downhill from the bottom of the photo up to the top. And the whole common landscape has been broken up into micro basins or rain gardens, okay? Where should this one fill up, it can overflow to the next and so on. But they've never overflowed. They're about 18 inches deep. But there's a problem with this photo, okay? This site has high clay soils. And the photo was taken after 2 inches of rain fell in less than an hour. So we've got standing water. Now, if that water stands for more than 3 days, we could potentially become a mosquito breeding factory because the most rapidly reproducing mosquitoes need 3 days to go from egg to adult. So we want to ensure that we infiltrate all that water well within that time period, preferably within 1 day. So the key to that is to create the sponge. So just a few weeks later, we mulched the basins with 4 inches of organic matter, just putting it on the surface, and we planted out the vegetation, creating the living pump. Now, with the sponge in place, we had another 2 inches of rain fall in less than an hour, and all of it infiltrated in less than an hour because the sponge was in place. We did not amend the soil or dig up the soil in any way. We just mulched and spongified the surface. This landscape, now that it's established, is irrigated entirely with rainwater and household wastewater. No drinking water. Looking at the site from above, we can see we've got many squares with numbers on it. Those are the buildings. The shaded area in between is the common landscape, and all the circles are trees. The slope is from the bottom left-hand corner to the top right-hand corner. And there is no stormwater detention retention basins underneath that key in the top right, because there's no runoff off of the site. We had this civil engineer add up the cumulative stored is a porous pavement. It's a gravel pave, and so there's no runoff off of that. So the next principle is we want to start with small and simple strategies. Why small and simple strategies? So you start! Okay, it's not intimidating. All right. So you could start by planting rain gardens. Just create a simple level-bottomed mulched basin in which or beside which you plant some vegetation. Ideally, native vegetation, vegetation indigenous to about a 25-mile radius of your site and a 500-foot rise or drop in elevation. Start with that. If you don't get the diversity you want, you can expand. But start with the local plants so you don't overlook superior local species. Because those species are the best adapted for your local rainfall patterns, your drought cycles, and your soils. So they are going to survive no problem without any outside inputs once established. But they will thrive if they're planted within or in conjunction with water harvesting earthworks, where they get additional resources, more water than they otherwise would, because they're not losing water to runoff now. And when you're wondering, well, what do I plant within these earthworks or beside? The answer to that is go take a hike. Because I want you to take a hike. I want you to go out into the areas where nobody's taking care of the landscape. You know, nice, intact parts of the local ecosystem where plants are surviving on their own. And see what plants naturally grow in the low spots, periodically inundated with water and sediment. Those are the same species you want in your low spots. And what are the species that need better drainage? That's what you put in the areas with better drainage. If you're planting exotic plants like some nice fruit producers, you want to put that fruit tree next to the earthwork, but hot, where the base of the plant is high and dry so it doesn't get crown rot, but the roots can access the water. And I emphasize starting with these strategies within the oasis zone, which is a 30-foot radius around the house. Why do I call it the oasis zone? That's because that's where the resources are, namely you, okay? You're the caregiver of this landscape, and you should also be reaping the benefits of this landscape. Create the oasis where you spend most of your time, right around the home. And then you can use the runoff from that home to boost the local water resources for the oasis zone, doubling the rainfall right around here. You can boost it further still with household gray water here. So we want the trees on the east, west, and north. This way, the trees, irrigated by the harvested water, become living air conditioners in summer and heaters in winter. How does that work? Well, this image here, the top three images, show you how the sun and shadow play on a house in the summer months. The right-hand side is the early morning, the top is noon, and the left-hand side is late afternoon. And the bottom images are the winter months. The right-hand side early morning, the bottom at noon, and the left-hand side late afternoon. And you need to know how the sun works throughout the year. The sun does not rise and set due east and west all year round. Okay? And don't tell anyone it does, because if you do, you'll be showing you're underaware. Okay? Thank you. So, to be more aware, I want you to realize that at this latitude, in the summer months, the sun will rise and set to the north of due east and west, and in the winter months, it will rise and set to the south of due east and west. So, knowing that, these trees on the east, west, and north will passively shade and cool you in the summer months in the rising and setting sun, because the lower part of this image is the south, the upper part is the north. And in the winter months, you get the full sun, free heat and light in your south-facing windows all day long. So in the summer, this tree planting can reduce in a 20 degree Fahrenheit reduction in summertime temperatures around the home compared to a home without such plantings. And in the winter months, you can easily, at this climate, take care of 50% or more of your potential heating needs. And I want you to look at not only the orientation of the vegetation and the landscape, but also the building. So the city of Davis, California in the 1970s did a very interesting study where they put minimum maximum thermometers in two identical apartment buildings and monitored the temperature fluctuations throughout a year without ever turning on any mechanical heating or cooling systems. And the only difference between these two apartment buildings is one was oriented so that it had the short wall face the rising and setting sun, and the other one was oriented so the long walls faced the rising and setting sun. And after the year's study, they found that the orientation... All right? So if there's such a huge difference in the performance of these two buildings, and the only thing was paying attention to their orientation to the sun, why don't we do this? I think we should mandate that all buildings be oriented for that optimization of passive heating and cooling. And I told this, I told friends in Boulder, Utah about this study. And they had a mobile home which was oriented with the long walls facing the rising and setting sun and a very short wall facing the winter sun to the south. And every winter they were spending $300 a month just to keep enough heat going into that mobile home to keep the pipes from freezing. But it was very uncomfortable to be in there. It was very cold. And so I told them about this, and they decided to up the mobile home and reorient it with the right orientation so that now this image here at the bottom shows the current orientation, and the photograph was taken in a summer morning. So you can see there's very little surface area absorbing the summer heat in the winter, in the summer morning, but we've got a long surface area that can capture the sun in the winter months when that happens. So they found that after doing this, their utility bills in winter dropped to just $50 a month. Okay, and not only did the pipes not freeze and they saved money, but it was for a change, it was actually comfortable to be inside without a jacket in the winter. Okay. So let's go back to the water harvesting. And okay, after showing that last slide, people might ask, why does this guy go into the solar stuff when this is a water harvesting talk? Okay, it's because for every kilowatt hour of power you consume, you're consuming at least a half gallon to up to 20 gallons of water at the power generation plant. Okay, and an average residence is using 700 kilowatt hours of power a month. Okay, so there's a huge amount of hidden water consumption just in our energy consumption. So that's why it's connected into this. All right, and it's juicier if you integrate everything and you know you do more for one strategy. Okay, so the next principle is you want to slow, spread, and sink the flow of water. So instead of sending the water straight out of the system, we want to zigzag it, okay? So there's more soil-water contact. There's more residency time. And I want to, actually, let me just go back to that. I want to create a rainwater harvesting class. And as part of that class, they select a part of the campus that is draining water, and then they turn it into a project where they retrofit it so it harvests water. So on the upper left here, we see the Aerospace Mechanical Engineering Building and the downspouts. We're sending the water right into the landscape, and the water would shoot right across into Speedway Boulevard after depositing sediment on the sidewalk and then into the street. So a real problem. So the students started digging a bunch of water harvesting earthworks, and now when it rains, the water comes out the downspouts, fills these basins, and passively irrigates the trees. And notice how sediment-rich that water is. All that sediment would have deposited posted it in the sidewalk and street. Now it stays on site, so things are getting better. On a slope site in an intensively used area, you might want to consider terraces. Okay, and this is in Los Alamos, New Mexico. And for their dry stacked retaining walls, they used an abundant geologic formation known as urbanite, or broken up sidewalk chunks. Okay, so they turned a waste into a resource. And since it's a dry stacked wall, meaning there's no mortar, in a very wet time, if there's surplus water, it can just freely leak out, so you don't have hydrostatic pressure pushing the wall over. And you want to ensure, if you build one of these, that if this is the slope, your retaining wall leans into the slope, at least a 10-degree batter, or lean into the wall. And every piece of urbanite or stone should also be sloped into the slope. Okay. This is a contour berm at Occidental, California, where they receive much more water, 60 inches of rain a year. And this contour berm and basin is about 80 feet long. It's about 2.5 feet wide at the basin, 2.5 feet wide for the berm. And it collects water from about a third of an acre site up above, that's above a septic leach field. They drain the area above the leach field into this. It used to just go into a gully that was ever deepening, but now it's more calmly deposited here. And they harvest over 600,000 gallons of water a year in this 80-foot long earthwork. Okay? If you were to buy a tank for that amount of money, you would spend easily $600,000, because more or less on average the tanks can go for about $1 a gallon. Okay? It depends on the type of tank. But the cost of this shade and so on. Another earthwork would be boomerang berms. So if you've got the water coming from the upper right, it will collect behind the berm that's open to the incoming water, and then the water drains out the side into the next. So you could have a whole hillside of this looking like miles of smiles or a lot of fish scales. Okay, and every climate's going to be different. In the much drier regions, such as the Negev Desert, where they only get 4 inches of rain a year, here you're going to have a fruit tree, and then you're going to go about 100 yards before you get another one. Because this landscape is irrigated just on that 4 inches of rainfall a year. Yet they produce pomegranates, olives, apricots, peaches, grapes. Okay? But what they do is they have a very large catchment area. This bottom right-hand side, you can see the area draining to the tree. And all you can see in the image in the upper left is this bottom square. The rest of that land is out of the picture. Okay. Now, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on a slope site, they are using contour berms of mulch made from chipped-up pinyon pine trees that died from the pinyon bark beetle infestation. Instead of leaving dead trees standing that could be a fire fuel, they cut the trees down, chipped and mulched them in the winter months when the bark beetles are dormant, and they spread the mulch on contour across the slope, which is this way. They put it across. So now the rain, instead of just flowing on down, it collects behind and infiltrates the soil. So after the rainy season, this is what it looked like. That bottom berm there is here in the lower part of this picture in the right. The upper berm and the photo in the upper left is right here in the lower right-hand photo. So they have created the living sponge. Okay? They've got it now because they infused the landscape with that water. And here in a canyon just north of Tucson, they've created a spring. Okay? So this is a bare bedrock drainage. And then they came in and put this low check dam across the flow. It's a speed hump in the flow of the water. So it slowed the water enough that sediment, organic matter, and seed could accumulate and collect upslope of that little check dam. And that has created a sand tank that rapidly infiltrates the water and slowly releases it. So now, after a big rain, well, before they built this, after a big rain event, you waited a couple hours and the water stopped flowing. Now, for 3 weeks after a good rain event, this spring continues to flow. This waterfall effect where the water flows over on like a sandy soil, it's going to scour out the bottom, okay, and it can erode it out. But on bedrock, you're set, okay? I'm going to skip by that one. The next principle is you always want to have an overflow and use that overflow as a resource. So if you've got a rainwater harvesting tank, you want to make sure your overflow pipe is at least as large a diameter as your inflow pipe. So all too often I've seen tanks with too small an overflow. A lot of rain barrels tend to be that way. So the tank overflows where you don't want it to overflow when there's a big rain event. And don't just send that overflow pipe to just a random area that might erode the landscape. Instead, send it into another tank or an earthwork, such as we have here, a basin that then irrigates a tree that can grow to shade and cool that tank. Because the cooler the temperature at which we store the water, the higher the quality of that water. And then notice we've got the slow it, spread it, sink it, zigzag effect going from earthwork to earthwork. The sixth principle is we want to maximize living and organic ground cover. Okay? Within your infiltration zones, you want organic matter and vegetation. So that over time, you're going to get more and more roots growing, more and more soil life and earthworms burrowing into the soil, making more microchannels through which the water can more rapidly infiltrate. So over time, it gets better. Okay? And you're also collecting the leaf drop and getting the closed nutrient loop. So we want to get away from the photo on the left where this gentleman is literally vacuuming his yard, okay? He's vacuuming up the leaf drop, all right? And he's strip mining the nutrients out of his landscape. Whereas the gentleman on the right-hand side is letting the leaves fall and accumulate as a beneficial mulch beneath the plant, and he's cutting up his prunings and adding to that mulch, which builds the soil and also reduces water loss to evaporation. And the seventh principle is we want to maximize the beneficial relationships and efficiency of our water harvesting strategies by stacking functions, by getting our strategies to do more than harvest water. Okay? Get the biggest bang for your buck. So if we've got an above-ground cistern, let's maybe put it on the east or west side of the house and send the overflow to a shade tree on the east or west side of the house so they double as passive shading and cooling in the summer months. And you can select a tree not only for shade, but food production, wildlife habitat, and the tank and the earthwork, cistern. And the water comes off the roof into the gutter and into the downspout and into the tank. And then there's a faucet right here from which we can access that water. So it's gravity feed in, gravity feed out. And the tank is right by the garden, so it's very convenient. But we're getting this tank to do a lot more than provide water because we put it on the western property boundary. So it doubles as an 11-foot long section of property fence. Okay. In addition, we put it in front of the neighbor's rental unit's bay window. So it's a wonderful privacy screen, okay? And we planted the other side of the tank to give them a different view. The other thing is the unit next door is not that well maintained. So if there is going to be a fire, it very well may come from the wiring next door. So I feel very good having a concrete tank full of water between us and them, okay? And then the tank, along with the tree, is placed on the west side of the garden. So it acts as an afternoon sunscreen. So this photograph was taken in the morning, but by 3 p.m., the sun has set on this garden because it's being shaded out by the tank and the tree. So when ambient temperatures are higher in the late afternoon and plants tend to be evapotranspiring and losing more water and being more heat stressed, we cool them off so they don't need so much water. Okay? So this is how you stack functions, how just giving a little more thought into your system and the materials you choose, you get a lot more out of it. And the last principle is the same as the first, the feedback loop, or said again, long and thoughtful observation. Because this is a living system, and we are just another living component among many. So we need to work with that system, see what's working, build on that, see what's not working, change that. And now I want to just give you some examples of all these concepts, and I want to introduce gray water harvesting. So gray water is the water from household bathroom sink, shower, bathtub, and washing machine. It is not the water from the toilet or the dishwasher. Those are considered black water because of the higher organic matter content. And most authorities consider kitchen sink water to also be a black water source, but I like Art Ludwig's classification of dark gray water. If you're going to harvest your gray water, a lot of organic matter in that water, that's food for bacteria. And stored in the tank, that gray water can go black or septic. It can go anaerobic and start to smell. So to avoid that whole problem producer, I much prefer gray water systems that use gravity to just send the water right out directly to a level-bottomed mulched basin or rain garden again. Okay, this time it's also a gray water garden. So you deposit the gray water beneath the mulch, okay, and beneath the surface of the mulch, and then the roots and the soil life becomes the living filter that bioremediates and utilizes that water. Okay, and I like to have my pipe outlet a couple inches above the mulch. There's no chance of root intrusion into the pipe, and I want to have a P-trap and a vent stack between the inside of the house and the outside so there's no chance of critters getting into the home. This is legal in both Arizona and New Mexico. Okay, so a number of years ago, it was illegal to harvest gray water in Arizona and New Mexico, but thousands of people were doing it anyway. And a study was done to see if all these people that were harvesting gray water, if there was any significant health risk. And they found that as long as people were following common sense, okay, there was no significant health risk. It was only when people would just deposit the gray water onto the surface and let it pool and fester that there were, you know, problems and conditions like that. So based on this study, the researchers went to the authorities and showed their findings, and the law was changed. They legalized gray water harvesting on the condition that people follow 13 common sense guidelines or best management practices. And I strongly encourage you all to approach your state and local authorities to do likewise. With this system in Arizona and New Mexico, there is no inspection, there are no fees, and there is no permit as long as you follow the best management practices. You do need to get a plumbing permit, as you always would, but there's not an additional layer of permits on top of that. And this has been very successful. It doesn't force one strategy, one recipe. It allows for innovation. And Arizona will now even pay you to harvest your gray water, up to a $1,200 state income tax credit. And I link to all of this, the study, the law, the rebates, on the gray water harvesting page of my website, which is harvestingrainwater.com. And that's the gray water stub out. It's in place, in your wall and in your floor. So once you move in, if you want to hook up to it, you can, as is illustrated in the photo on the right. Okay? This way you don't have to jackhammer a floor or drill through a wall. It's already there. And the key thing is, using a gravity-fed system, you want that pipe to outlet as high as possible out of the house so that you can distribute that gray water to as much of the landscape as possible. And you could even outlet it above soil level. The way this everything is interpreted in Arizona is the pipe and the plumbing is waste pipe inside the home, but as soon as the gray water pipe exits the wall, it's now considered irrigation pipe. Okay? So you get a plumber to do the work inside the home, you get the landscaping firm to do the work outside the home. And we want to make this convenient, so we put in a three-way valve, as your code currently requires you to do, but I like to push for that three-way valve to be inside the home. Because if you're taking a shower and you decide to bathe with bleach or something else that's toxic, you can very conveniently reach down and turn the valve so the water goes to the sewer instead of into your landscape, okay? So you can kill something else further down the line. Here in the upper left-hand picture is a three-way valve that's front and center and very visible. I love this. These people are really celebrating that they're harvesting the water. And if they send something toxic down the drain, they can turn the valve. If they're using good stuff, they can turn the valve to send it to the landscape. And the right-hand photo is showing one of those valves. And it's hard to see, but it's labeled. You got to label your pipe so you know when you turn that valve, Are you sending it to the sewer or the landscape so you don't just go down there? Okay. And with a washing machine, a great system you can do is a multi-pipe system shown here, where we've got multiple pipes. You've got your sewer pipe, which is already there, but you can put in one or three more pipes, each labeled with where the water goes. Okay, so when you're standing there, you just grab the drain hose and put it in a different pipe, depending on where you need to send the water. Super simple. And then each pipe sends the water to a different mulch basin. So this is a landscape in central Tucson irrigated entirely with rainwater and household gray water. So the rainwater comes off the roof, down the downspout, into the mulched sunken basins against the salt or sodium in it. Look at the ingredients of the detergent. Does it say salt or sodium anything? If so, put it back on the shelf. If it says biodegradable, doesn't mean much. Unfortunately, there's a lot of brands out there like Seventh Generation and Trader Joe's that say they're biodegradable. Sure, biodegradable, but they're not biocompatible for a gray water irrigated landscape in the western U.S. with alkaline soil. And it's best to use liquid-based soaps rather than powdered soaps, but even still, look at the ingredients. My favorite ones are Oasis brand and BioPack for dishwashing and laundry detergent, and Dr. Bonner's is a great one too. And I list many more on my website on the gray water harvesting page, so go for that. Now, combining rainwater and gray water harvesting, this is how we get the biggest bang for the buck. Let's start with the rainwater. This upper image shows that we've got 9,000 gallons of water coming off that roof in an average year of rain, and then we've got three low water use native shade trees, each needing about 3,000 gallons of water a year. So to meet all their irrigation needs, all they need is to be planted within or beside sunken water harvesting earthworks that collects rain and runoff. That's all we need. If we want to get a higher water use tree, like a fruit citrus tree, which needs 8,000 gallons of water a year, well, we can only plant one, because that's all we have enough water for. And the citrus tree is not adapted for the dry seasons and the droughts, so it needs a supplementary boost in the dry season with a gravity-fed gray water system. And if we want a lawn, well, that little section is all we get in the bottom right there. Okay. But what if we send that rainwater first to the washing machine? Well, we can get 750 loads of clothes washed before the water via the gray water pipes goes to the three shade trees or the fruit tree. Or if we don't want to send it to the washing machine, let's send it to the shower. And we get 900 showers before sending that water to the landscape. So you're getting a lot more for a lot less. And now let's look at harvesting water in the public right-of-way, okay? That section of land between your property line and the street. So this is my brother and I's home in central Tucson right after we purchased it. Got a great deal. It was about to be condemned, and it was in a real funky neighborhood, which meant it was a great place to live. So unfortunately, though, back then, much of the public rights-of-way were very bare and exposed, kind of a solar oven-heated moonscape. So we didn't really want a building community. So it's a neighborhood of friends, not strangers. That's where I want to be. And we also planted the rain before we planted the trees. So we started digging water harvesting basins and other earthworks and then planted the trees. So in just 10 years, this became this. No tree taller than a 5 foot gallon size. And over 90% of the species used in this are native or indigenous to the Tucson Basin. So we've created an island of the Sonoran Desert ecosystem within the urban core. So we used to only have exotic pigeons when we moved here. Okay, now most of those have left, and they've been replaced with over 24 native bird species, such as hummingbirds, cardinals, cactus wrens, Gila woodpeckers, and Gambel's quail. Yeah. And they are the natural gardeners. They are spreading this out throughout the neighborhood because this is now a living seed bank or gene pool. Because when it rains, water takes seed to downstream areas of the neighborhood. And when it's not raining, we've got the wildlife and the songbirds flying off and depositing seed into other parts of the neighborhood. This has also become a botanical gardens for the neighborhood. People love to walk up and down here, so we get to know more of our neighbors as they're walking by, building community even more. And it's also community flood control. Because we noticed that when it rained, the water would flow along the curb of the street just like an ephemeral creek. Because the street is raised or crowned in the middle and drains the water to the curb on either side. So if it flows like an ephemeral creek, it is an ephemeral creek. So let's treat it like one, but let's allow, well, let's first plant the vegetation that would naturally grow along that ephemeral creek, and then let's get the water to it. So we started making curb cuts. So we could let the water in off the street into the water harvesting basin, and the inlet is also the outlet. Once this fills with water, the water backs up on itself, and the surplus continues down the street in a safe, self-maintaining manner. We make sure that the pathway is at least as high as the top of the curb so we don't flood any adjoining properties. Okay? And here's a crazy statistic. The average residential street in Tucson drains over 1 million gallons of runoff per mile per year. Okay? That is enough water to sustain over 420 foot tall trees per mile. In 1996, here's the same tree 10 years later with my sister-in-law eating mesquite pods harvested from that tree. Okay? Which we grind up into a naturally sweet edible flour. We also have a bunch of honey from our backyard bees, olives from our olive tree, choya buds, wild chilies, prickly pear, jam, and all of this grown in the public right-of-way, the commons, just on harvested rain and street runoff. Okay. Yeah. You guys could be doing oaks and acorns, a wonderful native food source here, okay? So we want to make the processing of this native mesquite pod easier. Okay? So it's hard to grind it up quickly. So we got a hammer mill that we put on a trailer. This is part of a project we call Desert Harvesters. You can get more info at desertharvesters.org. So we take this mill around to different neighborhoods so the people that have planted and harvested from their mesquite trees can then quickly process it. You can grind 5 gallons of flour, or I'm sorry, of whole pods into 1 gallon of flour in 5 minutes and sell it for $15 a pound. So we've timed ourselves, and just leisurely picking, we can make $25 an hour. Okay? So this is also building the local economy. But we want to celebrate all this. So when we have our mesquite milling events, we also have mesquite pancake fiestas, where people can come out and try the mesquite in the form of the mesquite pancake with prickly pear syrup. They get really excited and happy, like Garth here in the lower left-hand side. And they want to do likewise. So we give them the information on how to plant the water and how to plant the trees, organize tree planting projects, and so on. We have live music, playground. We even have acorn bread and goods out there as well from the higher elevations. Okay. So people get excited and they want to take it to the street, quite literally. So here is where that was done. This is an intersection in the top left-hand corner before the work. Then the neighborhood got together and working with the city put in a traffic calming traffic circle. And then instead of building the soil up to the top of the curb, they depressed it. So it's actually below street level. Planted it with native food-bearing vegetation. And by getting everyone in there together, you know, get to know more neighbors. This now is also not only a traffic calming strategy, but a water harvesting strategy. And there's no curb cuts in the curb because it's in the high point or the raised part of the street. Okay? So the curb all the way around keeps water from draining out. Okay? Then we got a whole mural painted on the side of the automotive store. And people put in a community bulletin board right here after this photo was taken. And then other things started to appear, like this. And like this, and like this, okay? This is in another neighborhood where they put in water harvesting, traffic calming pullouts. So this pullout in the bottom right forces traffic to meander, and there's another one further on, so traffic slow, spread, and sunk, okay? Like water. And the curb is flush with the level of the asphalt, so water can flow over the curb, some of it infiltrate, and the surplus continue on. In Portland, Oregon, with the Green Streets Project, they're doing this even better. So this green strip here, that's where the curb used to be. They pushed out the curb 10 feet, as you can see in the upper left-hand corner. They made curb cuts to allow the water in. So that then, as you see in the lower left-hand photo, has narrowed the entrance and exit of that block, calming and slowing traffic, and making it more safe for folks like this little girl right here. But by also taking the runoff from the street, that flows into these rain gardens and gives much more water for the street trees that then grow to shade and cool the street, and also more aeration for their roots. In Seattle, Washington, they're doing even better still with the C Streets Project, or Street Edge Alternative Project, where in the left-hand side you can see what it looked like before. The upper right is what it was right after construction. They narrowed the street, reducing pavement by 11%. That gave them enough room to meander the street, slowing traffic and making it look a lot better, in my opinion. And then they put in a sidewalk, but only on one side of the street, not both. They had so slow traffic in the street, you could easily cross the street if needed. And by narrowing the street and only putting in one sidewalk, that gave them enough room for more sunken, mulched rain gardens or swales in which they planted indigenous vegetation. And in the bottom right, you can see what it looked like a couple years later. And this is reduced runoff by 98%. Okay, before they did this work, the local salmon populations were plummeting. Now the salmon populations are rebounding because the water quality has been greatly enhanced. Okay, and it's flood control. Selected what neighborhoods they would do this in and what blocks by seeing if they got 60% or so of the adjoining residents to agree to care for the landscape. So they're the citizen foresters that take care of it. Okay. So this is all building on natural patterns. If you go down a road, particularly in the drier southwest, you will see that the vegetation is much taller, bigger, and more dense beside the road where it gets direct rainfall and runoff compared to the vegetation further from that. In Melbourne, Australia, you can see the bottom left-hand photo. In a hyper-urban setting, they have a street tree, and there's a curb cut allowing the street runoff into that street tree basin. In Village Homes, Davis, California, in the middle photo, the water from the street goes into a bioswale irrigating trees in the landscape. Use the street as the irrigator. Portland, Oregon, in a more urban setting, people park on the street, and they have a 2-foot-wide pedestrian platform on which they can step off. And the water goes to the scupper into the basin to irrigate the trees. In Newcastle, Australia, they're doing something really dynamic with this otherwise conventional housing development under construction. Two things. First, they put in no raised curbs. So when the water comes off of the houses, which would be on the left-hand side of the photo, it goes over the street as sheet flow. Okay, spread out, slower moving, shallower flow. And then it more passively and calmly irrigates the street trees. And then that water flows over into the bioswale. It's bioremediated before flowing into the creek next to it. Okay? So by not putting in raised curbs, they have more of a sheet flow effect, which is calmer and easier to manage. Then the second thing is, they mandated in this development that any home that was adjoining a drainage way or a waterway had to front the waterway. And there had to be pedestrian pathways along the waterway. Okay? Now, all too often in new housing developments, you find that the waterways, the drainages, are weed, graffiti, litter-infested armpits. Okay? They're the forgotten zone. Because whether it's conscious or not, all the backyards face the waterway. And there's no gates. And there's no access. There's no pathway. So nobody wants to be there. And it becomes a problem. Whereas here, you have to have pedestrian access. So it becomes an amenity. It becomes a green belt. Okay? and it's cared for. You might have mosquitoes breeding in the water, or rats falling in, or small children, okay? And you're not losing water to evaporation. The other thing is you want to have your outlet pipe or faucet outlet about 4 inches off the bottom of the tank. This way, if any organic matter gets into the tank, it accumulates in the bottom as a sludge layer, but it's not drawn off with the water. So you get higher quality water coming out. Also, I highly recommend you screen all your inlets and your outlets. Okay, so again, no critters or mosquitoes are getting in. So a rainhead screen is a great strategy that sloughs off. It's a screen box at a 45 degree angle that sloughs off the leaves. In some ways, a lot better than gutter screens because you can see if it's clogged or not. You don't have to get up and look down in the gutter, okay? And then on your overflow, you can have a little gravity activated flap, okay? And it's great that Loomis Tanks is here tonight because they've got both those products you can check out, okay? Celebrate the Harvest of Rain. This is at the Children's Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The 10,000-gallon steel tank also doubles as a mural. And this here is a 10,000-gallon tank in Tucson, Arizona. That's the tank, and it's a terraced patio. The water comes off the roof into the tank. Via gravity, they irrigate the citrus trees below on the south side. You can have cistern building workshops. It builds community, shows people how to do this. You can do a culvert cistern style, where this is a steel culvert pipe, which is designed to drain water, but we set it vertically in a concrete base so it harvests water. But you can also do plastic fiberglass tanks and otherwise. Typically with these community building workshops, they will raffle off a tank at the end of the workshop, and if you win, you get it on the condition that you train your neighbors to help you install it. So keep spreading the info. And here is some images from Australia. And interestingly enough, people have been harvesting rainwater in the rural areas of Australia for a long time, well over 100 years. And that's typically the primary water source. In South Australia, over 90% of the rural residents get their water from harvested rain in tanks. But in the large cities of Australia, 10 years ago, it was illegal to harvest rainwater in a tank. And that is because in the large cities, you had a municipal water department that made its money selling water. So then the drought hit. And the reservoirs of communities such as Brisbane, Australia, were at less than 20% capacity. So they legalized the harvest of rainwater in tanks. Then they rebated it. The government will pay up to half the system. Then they mandated it. You can't build a new home without putting in a rainwater tank system. And they did something really interesting. They then send the rainwater tank water to the toilet's outdoor faucet and washing machine, not to the kitchen sink. So you don't need to worry about filtration because you're not drinking the water from the toilet typically. Now, if you want to direct the water to the kitchen as well, you can, but that's not mandated. So they have here in the lower left-hand photo a little gizmo called a rain bank. It's a sensor, and as long as there's water in your tank, it senses that and sends the water from your rainwater tank into the house to the toilet, outdoor faucet, and washing machines. When the tank's empty, it kicks off the tank and sends water from the city line into the house. Okay, so it works in all seasons. And the great thing is it also has become a form of community flood control. Because even in the wet season, you will be using the water in your tank and emptying your tank because your toilet and washing machine are using the water. So as the tank water level in the tank drops, you have more room for the next rain, okay? And you're not flushing that water into the street and the community storm drains. And they also have these great, sexy, slim tanks that fit in small footprint or small yards and can double as fences. And here's an example of that. All the tanks are put on the property line. This is larger cylinder tanks, which are creating a nice privacy screen for the deck. Sorry, it's a dark photo. And here in Portland, Oregon, they're really celebrating the rain, where the steelhead have returned, okay, as they swim up the steel downspout to the insurance office roof. And the water is caught in the rain garden below. And in downtown Seattle, Washington, they have the Growing Vine Street Project, where the folks living and working along that street envisioned narrowing the street, expanding the public right-of-way and pedestrian area, putting in street trees, irrigating them with the water off the adjoining rooftops, and also having cisterns and all. And so that's now starting to be implemented. And here you can see an example of that, where they have a cistern in the shape of a hand jutting out of the ground to capture the rain. And the water comes off of the roof of the condominium building in the downspout into the forefinger of the hand, fills the tank. Once full, it overflows into a bioswale, which then harvests the water to irrigate the trees, which will eventually grow to shade over the cars, acting as a living carport in the summer months. But the best part is right outside the patio of the cafe is this character in the lower right-hand photo, made out of recycled materials. And above him is the downspout from the roof with steel clouds around it, and the downspout shaped like a big shower head. So when it rains, the water pours down on him, and then it beneficially irrigates the rain garden below him. But as it does so, it hits his umbrella, which is made out of propellers. And it's kinetic, it moves. So when the water is pouring down, all of a sudden the umbrella starts to whip around, and it starts to move him. He starts to do a little wiggle. He starts to do a little dance. He starts to do a little bun dance. So hopefully this talk has shown you the potential of what you can do with water harvesting, okay? But I want you to ground you in some reality, because sometimes after talks like this, people are like, oh man, there's no limit. I'm going to go home, make a little rain garden, and plant a pecan orchard. And then a citrus orchard. And on and on. Well, no, that's not going to work, okay? Not if you want to be sustainable. So we need to get an idea of what is our site's water income. Okay, so you can easily do a calculation I've got here. It's in my books on the website, where you do the width and length of your site in feet, gets the catchment area in square feet. You multiply that by your average rainfall in feet, multiply that by 7.48 to convert cubic feet to gallons. That will tell you how many gallons of rain typically fall on your site in an average year of rainfall. Okay, that's your income. Now look at your water bill. And make sure you do not consume more water in a year than actually falls on your site in a year. Okay? This is the beginnings of becoming more sustainable with our local water resources. All right? And if you are using more water than falls on your site, you got to make some changes. But you also need to get out when it rains and see what's really going on. You can't stop with that calculation. If you are losing a lot of water, like in these darker areas of the illustration on the right, if that water is draining off-site, you got to subtract that from your budget because you don't have it. It's leaving. All right? And if you get some run on, you've got 9,000 gallons coming off your roof in an average year. If you're using 370 gallons of water a day, that's only the roof runoff is only going to last you 24 days. But if you can reduce your daily consumption to just 114 gallons of water a day, that 9,000 gallons of roof runoff is going to last you 78 days. And then if you really want to be conserving but still be comfortable, you can just use 20 gallons of water a day. That's what my household uses. That'd be 20 gallons per person per day. That will make that 9,000 gallons of roof runoff last you 450 days. Okay? So if you all want to get more information, I strongly recommend you go to my website, harvestingrainwater.com. I got a lot of free resources there. If you put demonstration sites into the search box, you'll get links to all kinds of dynamic projects throughout the U.S. and Australia and the world. If you put in financial incentives in the search box, you'll get all kinds of great links to rebates and tax credits and so on that you can then perhaps initiate in your community by showing what others are doing. And I've got a part of the site that's images, video, and audio. So you can show people, if you go to your neighborhood meetings or city meetings, you can bring images of what you're talking about. Because if you get all excited and you go to your neighbor and say, we got to harvest that water, you do it, did you? Blah, blah, blah. Like, what are they talking about? All right? And the image in their head is going to be different than the image in your head. But if you can show them an image and see this is how it's working, you're working off the same thing. Okay? And there's more understanding more quickly. And I got to do a quick little plug, too, if you guys would like to get either of my books. Volume 1, Volume 2 are for sale. Volume 1 is the core of the series. That's where I recommend everyone begin. Shows you how to assess your site, figure how much water you've got, gives you the argument to do this. It goes into the principles in detail and shows you how to integrate your system and figure out if you want to harvest water in tanks, earthworks, or both. And then the second book, it's the next step. It's more specific step-by-step strategies, how you implement the various earthworks if that's the way you want to harvest your water. And I've got postcards that are free up here with the website if you want to take that. And also, I'm a self-published author. I'm the author, the editor, the marketing team, the distributor. So if you want one of these sexy rainwater harvesting caps to become a walking, talking bill being set up. Oops. Okay, ignore the screen. Ignore it. No. And let me tell you the backstory while she sets that up. So, currently, Los Angeles, California spends $1 billion a year importing water. That's what the water department's doing. While at the same time, the flood control department is spending millions of dollars more exporting $500 million worth of storm water. Okay, so the two departments are fighting one another. Then you've got a solid waste department sending waste to the dump every day in diesel trucks. 40% of that waste stream is mulch. Okay, which could be kept on site, okay, to fertilize the soil and quicken water infiltration. And against this backdrop, you also need to know that over 60% of Los Angeles is currently paved over, with more of it being paved all the time. And this is increasing the amount of water that's flashing off site and upping the peak flood flows, threatening to flood the lower half of LA County. So in 1992, recognizing this flood problem that had been caused by the excessive paving, the Army Corps of Engineers came up with a solution to raise the banks of the LA River an additional 10 feet. So if any of you watched Chips as a kid and saw the car chases and this concrete-clad drainage way, well, that's the LA River. And they wanted to raise it more. So thankfully, the Andy Lipkus, the founder of the nonprofit group Tree People and his organization, recognized how ridiculous this was. They weren't addressing the problem. They were only putting Band-Aids on the symptom. So they went to the authorities and said, look, we have to depave the excessive pavement. We have to create rain gardens, green streets, water harvesting strategies from the upper part of the watershed all the way down to the bottom so we don't have the runoff in the first place. But the authorities couldn't see it. They didn't understand what was being said, okay? So they realized they needed to do street theater to show them what they meant so they could see what they meant. So they put out press releases to all the media that went something like this. At 12 noon on Tuesday, at one central LA address, a single-family residence, there will be a 1,500-year flood. But everything will be okay. Come and see what happens. And this is what they saw.
Well, 2 tons of water fell on a Southland house today, but it wasn't an accident.
Roof drains, which all over the city send water to the street, redirect the water so it flows into the lawn. We've sunken the lawn a little bit or raised a berm around it so it can capture thousands and thousands of gallons. We've taken water from the rooftop and put it into the cistern, these tanks. These tanks are here. They feed the irrigation system.
The two 1,700-gallon cisterns can also pump the water into the street via an underground pipe if need be. In the driveway, oil-polluted water drains into a dry well and is filtered before seeping into the ground. The high-tech equipment is complemented by the use of old-fashioned compost and mulch in the garden that acts as a sponge for the rainwater.
All our cities were built without understanding nature. This is about working in partnership with nature.
I'm very honored and pleased and privileged to have this my home as a test site for something that can be used in the next millennium.
The cost of retrofitting most homes would average $10,000. It's hoped the agency sponsoring this project will pick up the tab and make this a reality in L.A. in the next 15 to 20 years. In South Los Angeles, Tiu Leek, KTLA News.
Okay, so the folks with the umbrellas, those are the local water authorities. And after this, they saw it. They finally got it. And they said to Andy and the tree people, they said, we think you've cracked it. You've cracked the problem. So the next week, they canceled a $40 million project that would have been more concrete-clad drainage infrastructure. And they instead allocated that money to the Sun Valley Watershed Project, which is implementing these strategies that Andy and the tree people were pushing for. And you can go to sunvalleywatershed.org or treepeople.org to get more information on this project. They've now spent over $300 million. And the whole idea is for the Sun Valley sub-watershed to be a demonstration of all these various different strategies to show LA a different way and push it in a different way. And along with these efforts, which have incorporated a lot of different government officials, citizenry, private sector, and so on, they've also now created a new department which is the Watershed Management Division, with the goal of managing the city of LA as a forested watershed. Okay? And so the whole thing here, the take-home message of this is, you guys might get really excited about water harvesting, go home and get, you know, really jazzed, and when it rains, you might get so excited you're going to run out naked or in your underwear just to see your water tank and your earthworks fill up with water, okay? And you're going to get a wreck, going to want to do it. And the only time a drop in the bucket is a problem, if it's a drop in the bucket of scarcity, okay? And that's the old model. Let's move on to the new. And this demonstration house that you saw in L.A., one house, but that largely because of that, LA is shifting the way it manages water, because that example enabled them to see what's possible. And every one of you can do the same in your own home site, in your neighborhood. Okay, this community can show other communities. So I invite you all to be a drop in the bucket of abundance. Okay, and thanks so much for coming out.
I know we are a little bit behind schedule and everyone's probably a little bit anxious to go. When you came in, you should have received a survey as well as the low impact development paper. If you could please take the time to fill out those surveys, we have some pencils and you will receive raffle tickets, three of them. Go ahead and keep one side for yourself, tear the other. We'll have the music playing. Please visit our displays. Starting over here, we have Brad Lancaster's, and then we have some strawberries provided by Living Soil Organic Farm. One of the members of the band over here is actually an organic farmer in the Morro Bay watershed, so they're delicious strawberries. We have Cayucas Brewing Company and Cayucas Cellars if you would like additional drinks. And we have Loomis Tank in the back corner. We have the County and Wallace Group Projects. We have the Morro Bay Estuary Program, the City of Morro Bay, and Invisible Structures, who you can all engage with. And because we are a little behind schedule, we'll have music play, and at 9:45 we'll do the raffle and then let them continue to play and people to see the displays. Thank you. California for the whole month of September. So go to the events page of my website and tell friends north of here and south of here. I may very well be coming to their community and they can check it out. Okay.